Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Philadelphia, was an amateur boxer, a nightclub singer, and a pianist. He became a writer and has been voted the number one sports columnist in the nation 13 times by the Associated Press. He's a panelist on ESPN's Sports Reporters and is the author of 9 books, including Tuesdays with Maury, and his latest book, Have a Little Faith, which will be released this coming week. He's written 3 plays and hosts a nationally syndicated radio talk show. His name, Mitch Albom. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Mitch Albom, whose newest book, Have a Little Faith, will be released this coming Tuesday. Mitch, welcome back. It's an honor to have
nice
you.
Nice to see you, Jack. Thank you.
Mitch Albom, you do a show for 2 hours on JR, 5 afternoons a week, 2 hours each day. ESPN, the sports reporters, every other week. 9 books, 3 plays. You've got a band. How do you do it all?
Well, I don't watch a lot of television, Jack, and I only say that half-jokingly. I think you have more time in your day than you realize if you don't spend it on a lot of things that can suck up your time. And I'm pretty much do the things that I love to do, of which you just mentioned them, and when I'm not, I'm with my family. And that's about it. I'm not real exciting. I don't go to parties. I don't go to openings. I don't... You know, the only time I put a suit on is television or a religious service, and I don't, you know, I think when you cut that kind of stuff out of your life, you can actually get more accomplished than you want. But you're nice to say all that, but I think people have the impression that I do more than I do. I do a little bit of a lot of things. I'm a part-time sports writer, to be honest, and I'm on the radio, but I get more time off than the next 5 guys in a row, and yes, I write books, but I don't put them out every year like James Patterson puts out 6 a year. You know, I mean, I'm 3 years in between books, and I write plays, but it's years between plays. So I just kind of go where the creative spirit takes me.
You are a fabulous storyteller. Mitch Albom, why do people love to hear stories?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think since the dawn of time, we have been storytellers. We are a storytelling species. And whether it was sitting around a campfire or writing hieroglyphics on a wall, the idea of a story has never gone away. I think stories will survive mankind, and ultimately, if mankind is ever gone, stories will surpass mankind, because that's what will be written down somewhere as to who we were and what we did. But there's nothing more seductive for most people than just saying, hey, let me tell you what happened, and guess what happened next? Even when you're a kid, when somebody says that, and guess what happened next? You're piqued. You know, and that same curiosity is the same thing that makes somebody turn a page or makes somebody listen to your next sentence on the radio. There's just something about the idea of telling a story, and it's unique to humans. I mean, it's not like dogs sit around and tell stories to one another, but it's something about the way we communicate, and I have been blessed with a love for storytelling. I don't know how good I am at it, but I know I love to do it, and so I work at it all the time.
The Bible, a book of stories.
Yeah, greatest story ever told, some say.
Don Hewitt was the founder and producer of 60 Minutes, mm-hmm. died recently, mm-hmm. and they had a whole show dedicated to him. And somebody once asked him, what does 60 Minutes do? And he answered, quote, 4 words. Tell me a story.
Mm-hmm.
What do all the great storytellers have in common, Mitch?
They have an ability to make you wonder what's coming next and want to see how it all ends up. And that could be a love story. You want to find out if the guy gets the girl. That could be a thriller. You want to find out if they catch the bad guys. That could be the Bible. You want to see where it's all going. That could be 60 Minutes, where they introduce a situation at the beginning, and then they tell you the controversy of it, and they even that tick, 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 tick thing is moving you along. It's moving you along. Anyone who can tell a story has the ability to tick, 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 tick silently behind the pages or behind the movie or whatever, and people feel like they got to keep going. Someone who can't tell a story, you'll always know because in your head, even if you're too polite to say it, you're kind of going, I wish they would finish already. I have a dental appointment, you know, you know, I hope I haven't ever done that to too many people, but, you know, I'm sure there's a few out there might say it. But for the most part, I like to think I can keep people interested.
12 years ago, you write a book, Tuesdays with Maury, which now is the best-selling memoir of all time. Mitch Albom, how did that happen?
By accident, Jack. I mean, and I think that was one of the best and most instructive lessons I ever had, was that sometimes the biggest things that are going to happen to you in your life are going to be totally unexpected, and you can plan all you want, but there's an old expression, man plans and God laughs. And, you know, I think there's something to that. You know, we all think we're in such control of our destiny. I found out with Tuesdays with Maury that I wasn't, because I had been a sports writer. I had a very successful life and career, and I was a certain kind of person, I think, when that was all happening. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I happened to find out that my old professor was dying from Lou Gehrig's disease. I hadn't seen him in 16 years. I felt guilty, so I made a phone call. I could have not made the phone call, but I did. He invited me to come see him. I could have not gone, but I did. I went and saw him one time and saw how he was dealing with his illness. I could have not come back, but I did. Eventually, he told me that he didn't have enough money to pay his medical bills. I could have shrugged at it, but I didn't. And I said, well, I need to do something because this man has kind of bared his soul to me here. And so I decided, well, the only way I could help him pay his bills is if I wrote a magazine story or a book or something. I wrote it. Nobody wanted it. I got turned down all over the place. So many people told me no to Tuesdays with Maury. You wouldn't believe it. Now, in retrospect, you look at it, but really, nobody, they thought it would be boring. It's about death. Nobody knows this guy. You're a sports writer. You name it. And I did it because it was an important thing to do, not because it was going to get me fame or well-known, but because I wanted to help him. Found one publisher, wrote the book, came out. They printed 20,000 copies, thought they'd be lucky to sell those. And now I think it's at something like, I don't know, 15, 16 million. And I had no idea. So when you say, how did that happen? It happened by accident. And as a result of that accident, my life has never really been the same.
We're talking to Mitch Albom. And now, 12 years later, he writes another nonfiction entitled Have a Little Faith. He starts the book this way. This new book, Have a Little Faith, is my first nonfiction work since Tuesdays with Maury. It is, in my view, the most important thing I've ever written. When we come back, we'll ask him why. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with our own Mitch Albom. Mitch, this week, Have a Little Faith comes out. First nonfiction since Tuesdays with Maury. Why did you write the book?
Well, like Tuesdays with Maury, I didn't see it coming originally about 9 years ago. I was asked by an old rabbi who I'd known my whole life if I would do the eulogy at his funeral for him when he died. And it threw me, just like I think when Maury said, would you come back and see me next Tuesday? It was one of those things, do I really want to do this? How am I up to this? Who am I to do a eulogy for somebody who does eulogies? I mean, shouldn't that be a fellow man of God, you know? And I wasn't very religious. I had been trained when I was younger. I had been exposed to religion, but I kind of walked away from it. And all of a sudden, this man is asking me to do his eulogy. So the only thing I could think of was, well, I need to get to know you as a human being. I mean, if you're going to eulogize somebody after they die, you have to know more than just what it was like to sit in their congregation. And so I began to go see him, and I thought when somebody asks you for a eulogy, you think that in your mind, well, they're down to the last month or two. Turned out that he lived through a number of battles of strokes and heart attacks, but he lived another 8 years. So I kept visiting and going and going, and it turned into quite something different. At the same time, I got involved here. You may know, some of the listeners here know, that I'm involved with the homeless here in Detroit. And I began to get involved with churches that helped out the homeless, and I discovered this one church that the homeless sleep at on several nights a week that had this huge hole in its roof. I mean, a massive hole where rain and snow would come in and literally would snow on the congregation. They would have to build a plastic tent in the wintertime inside the sanctuary to sit and pray. And there was a pastor there who had been a former convict, a former drug dealer, a former thief, everything bad you could think of, who turned his life around 20-some-odd years ago and now ran this church. So here was this pastor, African-American, poor, taking care of the homeless in Detroit. And here was this rabbi in a well-to-do community, white, Jewish, suburban, 82, you know, older, the other guys. They couldn't be more different, Jack. Could not be more different. And they were both struggling. The older man about to die. The younger man trying to keep his church from literally collapsing or closing down. They shut the heat off on him. He owed $37,000 in bills and all the rest of it. And yet I saw a calmness, a peace, a serenity between with both of these men, despite the fact that they couldn't have been more different. And I said to myself, I want to find out more about that peace. You know, I don't know too many people at peace. Most people I know are pretty agitated. They're like walking posters for Starbucks coffee, you know, jitter, 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 nerve, 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 stress, stress, stress. And what I found over 8 years, and it took me 8 years to basically put this book together, was that what they had in common was faith. Not the exact same method of it. You know, they each had their own religious views, but a faith in something bigger than them. And that's what enabled them to face these very difficult problems. And I move between these two worlds and find out that actually we have a lot more in common between our faiths than we think we do.
Can you tell us a little bit about Rabbi Albert Lewis?
He was a poor kid, grew up in Brooklyn, dirt poor, lived on rolls during the Depression, had one suit, you know, his entire life, you know, that they just kept letting out the garments on, you know, make them longer, sew it up, all the rest of that thing. Thought he wanted to be a teacher. Ultimately, tried the seminary, failed, and was back in a camp counselor role when he had a second opportunity and became again, and turned out to go down and take over this little synagogue in New Jersey that was pitched between two churches. There was an Episcopalian church on one side and a Catholic church on the other side, and this little synagogue right in the middle. I mean, literally across the street from one another, in a community of eight churches. And this was the only synagogue. He was the only Jewish cleric anywhere in the area. The Jewish community was the only one anywhere in the area. And from 1948, which is when he went there, until 2008, which is when he died, he was the spiritual leader of this one little synagogue there. And he, you know, saw the whole change of events. And I grew up in that area, and he was the first cleric I ever had and the only one. I never joined another synagogue. I always would go back there on the holidays, no matter where I lived. He was a funny guy, a singer. He was the kind of guy who would greet you always with a song. If he saw me, he'd say, "Hello, Mitchell. Well, hello, Mitchell. It's so nice to," and he'd sing like that, and you'd have that stupid smile on your face, like, you can stop singing now. But he would just keep going. Everything was a song. And he just had a warm, wonderful way of engaging people. And what's funny is that when I was a kid, he was a very big guy. You know, he's well over 6 feet and tall and handsome guy and a lot of hair. And whenever I would see him coming when I was a kid, I would always run. Because he was the man of God, and you were supposed to... I just figured I must have done something wrong. I don't know what, but I must have done something, and he's going to scold me. Same way you are with a priest or pastor or anybody. And here I was all these years later when he was dying. Now I was coming back to him, which was kind of the opposite. And I really got to know him as a human being in the last 8 years of his life versus, you know, that kind of man of God on the pulpit thing that I had had all the time I was growing up.
The second main character, Reverend Henry Covington, pastor of Pilgrim Church / I Am My Brother's Keeper Ministries. Please tell us about...
Well, Henry could not be more different than Albert, although they both grew up in New York and they both grew up poor. Henry grew up, I mean, dirt poor. His father was a hustler. His mother was a maid. He lived in an apartment with six brothers and sisters and rats so bad that they used to put a pot of rice on the counter in the kitchen at night so that the rats would jump into the pot of rice and not come into the bedrooms. He witnessed his mother try to shoot his father when he was just a kid. She was taken away to prison. He actually visited her in jail through the glass several times. By the time he was in sixth grade, he was thrown out of school. By the time he was 15, he was a criminal. By the time he was 18, he was in jail for manslaughter, for something he actually didn't do, although he had done enough stuff to go to jail for. And by the time he got out, he fell into the world of drugs and dealing, and he just spiraled down until one night when he was about 30 years old, he was so desperate and so strung out that he robbed his own drug dealers, which is about the dumbest thing that you can do, even in a dumb world like drugs. He robbed his own drug dealers and ran home with the drugs and took them and got high and then realized, oh my God, they know where I live. And he ran out front of his house. He had a wife and a little daughter at the time. And that night, which was the Saturday night before Sunday morning, which was Easter Sunday, behind a row of trash cans, holding a shotgun, expecting these drug dealers to drive down the street and shoot up his house in any minute, he looked to the heavens and he said, "Jesus, if you get me out of this, I'm yours. Just get me through to the morning." He made it through to the morning. It was Easter morning the next morning. He put the shotgun under his bed. He lay down. He turned to his wife and he said, "Let me ask you a question. What's keeping you from going to God?" And she looked at him and she said, "You are." And he went into the bathroom, closed the door, and drank a bottle of NyQuil, knocked himself out for a day and a half, woke up, drank another bottle of NyQuil, knocked himself out for a day and a half, woke up, drank a third bottle of NyQuil, knocked himself out. By the time he came around, he had broken his addiction to the drugs, and he slowly began this path back, which ultimately led him here over the course of the next two decades to run this very broken down but spirited church on Trumbull right here in Detroit called the I Am My Brother's Keeper Ministry, what I call the church with the hole in the roof, which he runs to this day.
A few months ago, I had a fellow, Peter Pretorius, a South African, Formula One race car driver, tobacco farmer, pilot, and in 1984, he watched at least 30 kids starve to death a day for 10 straight days in Mozambique. And he heard God say, "Feed them." Today, he and his wife are feeding 500,000 kids a day. And one thing he said was, "I've learned much more from the poor than I ever have from the rich."
Well, I think that's true. That's not to say that the rich don't have things to teach us. But I think that parts of your heart are touched in a way when you see people who need help that are not when you see people who don't. What I've learned from the poor is the character that can endure in human beings, that the faith that can endure in human beings, even when their circumstances are the toughest. It's easy to say, "Yeah, I believe the world is good, and yeah, God is good, and humankind," when you're sitting in a comfortable home with a comfortable car with a comfortable job. It's another thing when you're sleeping outside, when you're begging for food, when you're shivering in the cold, to still have faith in humankind and faith in something bigger than you, to not just turn around and curse God, you know, as we saw Job ultimately do when he was tested, and say, "Well, there can't be anything good in this universe because look at me, look at my terrible conditions." And I have witnessed amongst the homeless, particularly here in Detroit, amazing character, amazing resilience, amazing kindness. Where you expect bitterness, it often isn't there. And if I've had my eyes open to anything, and I hope I can try to open other people's eyes to it with regard to homelessness, it's that there's this stereotype about homelessness that somehow these people deserved it, that they're crazy or they're perpetually drunk or they got a screw loose and they're just wandering around drooling and talking to themselves, and so they have no hope. I mean, you could dress them up and you can give them a job and they'll be back on the street in 2 days. Nothing could be further from the truth. These are people who hit a bad patch, who got fired, who had an industrial accident maybe and can't work, you know, who had a bad divorce, who just lost a house and a mortgage. There's so many new homeless every day in today's economy that are people just like you and me, Jack, you know, a year ago, living out in the suburbs. Now, all of a sudden, they're taking families from one shelter to the other. And I think if people lost that stereotype, and the way you lose it is simple. There's no magic formula. You just go down and help out. All you got to do is, I can give you a list of shelters in Detroit if you want, and all you got to do is go down and spend one night and you'll see what I'm talking about. So I've learned that from the poor, and I think your guess was right. But mostly you learn it about yourself, and I think that that's what the poor have to offer us. We learn about how much more we could be doing, and how much more compassion we should have when we see people who are in need.
We're talking to Mitch Albom, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Now, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Mitch Albom, the author of 9 books and 3 plays. Mitch, an excerpt from the book, if you would. How can any of us let you go? This is part of the eulogy. You're woven through us from birth to death. You educated us, married us, comforted us. You stood at our milepost, our weddings, our funeral. You gave us courage when tragedy struck, and when we howled at God, you stirred the embers of our faith and reminded us, as a respected man once said, that the only whole heart is a broken heart. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that... Sorry, I got a little choked up when you read that, because I haven't thought about that in a little while. What I meant is that, and I think what the man who said it meant, is that unless you've experienced the sadness of loss and grief and lost somebody in your life who's dear to you, you don't know the whole capacity of love and the deepness of it, because you think it's going to go on forever. You know, it's that old expression, you never appreciate what you have until it's gone. Well, that's part of having a whole heart. The truth is, until you lose people, you don't realize how precious every day is. You know, I started to have that happen to me with Maury, and I've continued to have it with many people who have died, sadly, in my life since Maury. And, you know, that is what priests, pastors, clergymen, rabbis... they do. They remind you, yes, there is sadness in life, but sadness in life is part of what makes happiness in life as rich as it is. So that's what I meant by that part of that eulogy.
Another part of the book, you're talking about Reverend Henry, and you say, I thought about his dilapidated church downtown, and I realized that most of us have a hole in our roof, a gap through which tears fall and bad events blow like harsh wind. We feel vulnerable. We worry about what will come through next. That's today's story, Mitch. The challenging times, what have they taught us?
Well, hopefully they've taught us that we're not here to rely on our jobs, and we're not here to rely on our workplaces or our stock portfolios or our 401ks, that we're here to rely on each other. And one of the things that I learned in Have a Little Faith was the value of a community. And, you know, I seem to learn all my lessons the hard way. I make the mistake. It's a doozy of a mistake, like not seeing my professor for 16 years. And then I have this great gift of an opportunity to try to make up for it. And that's why I don't mind admitting my mistakes in my books. I mean, a lot of times people say when I write about myself, well, you're so hard on yourself, or you're not trying to come across well, you should have complimented yourself. And I said, but I don't feel that way. I don't mind admitting my flaws, because I think that helps teach other people. You know, what good is it if you write a book about all your great traits? There's nothing to learn from that. But my mistake with Maury, or now my mistake when in this book, I left that community. I had that community when I was growing up. I had a small, tight-knit religious community that I belonged to, and I thought it was cliched. I thought it was too small. I thought it was too inhibiting. I couldn't wait to get out. And every time when I would go back every year for the holidays, and I'd see all these same people in the congregation, and I would think, oh, I have such a more exciting life than these people. You know, I get to travel around, and you know, I do television, I do all these things. And these people are exactly where I left them, you know. And I almost, in a haughty way, you know, when I was younger, sort of felt sorry for them. Oh, too bad they can't. And when I started going back to visit Albert Lewis, who we called the Reb, I saw how he stitched that community together and how precious that community was. And now, as you point out, in hard economic times, I've watched people when they get fired from their jobs. It's almost like they're wiped off the face of the earth as far as the workplace is concerned. You're not supposed to talk to them anymore. They're not supposed to come around anymore. A lot of people don't even want to talk to them anymore because they feel like it's contagious. Wow, he got fired. If I talk to him, I'll get fired. Like unemployment is something contagious. So where do they go? They don't go to their bosses, who they used to, you know, spend so much time worrying about. They don't go to their colleagues, who they used to worry about. Do they like me? What do they think? How should I dress? They end up going to their family or their church, or their synagogue, or their mosque, or their community, where they belong. Those are the people who take care of them. Those are the people who come over with casseroles and say, here, you know, I know you were, help you out for dinner tonight, or hey, we heard you had an operation, you needed some money, and the people take up a collection. And we forget how valuable those communities are until we get hit with hard times like we're having now. And that's where people are returning to, these sort of faith-based communities, neighborhoods where they're from. And I started to see the value of mine, even back where I grew up. Now, I don't live there anymore, but I think that's part of what I've embraced here in Detroit. I've sort of tried to make my own little community here in Detroit of people and friends and people who I can help and who can help me, and it's helped me feel more a part of things.
You're organizing a special evening this coming Wednesday, September 30th, at 7:30 p.m. at the Fox. Tickets through Ticketmaster.com or 800-745-3000. Tell us about that special evening.
Well, in the tradition of releasing books, usually they have a party for the author when they release his book, and it's a cocktail party in some fancy place. And I always thought that that was a little indulgent. I had one, you know, my first book, and I said, this is, you know, I don't feel comfortable. I don't like to be the center of that kind of attention. Maybe I could use the spotlight that you get for releasing a book for some better good. And I started 3 books ago doing these charity events. And this turns out to be the third one, which I invite some people that I know who are well known, and they come in and tell stories, they sing, they perform, whatever it is that they do, and we raise money for charity. In this case, it's at the Fox Theater, only we have a special twist to it that just happened about a week ago. Ernie Harwell read an early copy of Have a Little Faith, and I was out at his house visiting with him after he, you know, revealed that he was dying from inoperable cancer. And I've loved Ernie for many years and had a nice relationship with him. And I went out and spent, and he mentioned to me that he had read the book and that he really liked it, and that I told him about the event. He said, well, I'd like to be a part of that. And so now Ernie Harwell will join us, in addition to Anita Baker, who's a wonderful singer, a Grammy Award winner, and has got a wonderful story of her own to tell. Dave Barry, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning humor writer, very, very funny guy, wrote, written 1,000 funny books. He's in a band with me of writers called the Rock Bottom Remainders, and we're actually going to do a number, believe it or not. Hopefully we won't clear the place out once we do that, in addition to him telling stories. Joe Dumars, the president of the Pistons and the Hall of Famer, he'll be there. Kem, the R&B star, will be there. Our own Ken Brown, my partner, will be there doing the comedy, and a bunch of other people, including Henry Covington, who is one of the characters of the book, be on stage. And we're going to tell stories, talk about career, talk about faith, sing songs, perform all that. And all the money we raise, every single dime, and I mean every dime, Jack, you know, we don't pay out to anybody, or if we do, it comes out of my pocket, goes to help the homeless here in Detroit through faith-based groups that are helping them out, because that's kind of the theme of the book. And I think having Ernie Harwell there in what I'm sure will be one of his last opportunities to, and not because I hope Ernie lives many, many more years, but I think Ernie's kind of winding it down in terms of public appearances, to talk about his story and his faith. And I just, my goal is to fill that place for the standing ovation that I know Ernie's going to get when he finishes talking. And you know, I like him so much, and I hope we can do that. So I hope people come out. We kept the price of the ticket very low, and it includes an autographed copy of the book. So if you count that in, it's actually a pretty decent deal. It's only $40, and you can get tickets at Ticketmaster.
We're talking to Mitch Albom. When we come back, we'll ask him about Ernie Harwell. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Anything is possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Mitch Albom, and this coming Wednesday at the Fox, 7:30. Tickets, 800-745-3000, or go to Ticketmaster.com. A week or so ago, we honored Ernie at Comerica Park. And something happened when he went down to the stadium, on the way to the stadium.
Yeah, very few people know this until I wrote about it in the Free Press, because I only found out about it secondhand. But as I mentioned, Ernie had read the book, Have a Little Faith, an early copy of it, and he was very taken with Pastor Henry Covington and his efforts to keep a church going in the poorest section of Detroit, where homeless people sleep on the floor, and there's a big hole in the roof, and rain comes in. And on his way down to that night, which was this huge night for Ernie. I mean, you know, it was broadcast all around the world. They were honoring Ernie Harwell. This was his spotlight moment, you know. And if anything, he should just be thinking about himself. He's obviously not well, and he was driving down there with his friend Gary Spicer. And what does he do on his way to the park? Instead of just going to the park and receiving as much glory as he could, he drives to that real poor neighborhood in Detroit, not too far from the old Tiger Stadium, and drives by the church because he wants to see the church. And he sees Henry Covington, the pastor, out in the street, because in the summertime it's hot and they tend to sit outside. And he rolls down the window and he says, are you Pastor Covington? And Henry says, yes. And he says, well, I'm Ernie Harwell. I read about you in that book and I just wanted to say hello. Now, this is about 10 minutes before he gets to Comerica Park. And he didn't tell anybody about it, didn't say where he was when he got there. 10 minutes later, he's walking into Comerica and everybody's cheering. That's what he was doing beforehand. And that, to me, it's always those little quiet things that you never hear about that tell you about the character of a person. And I think that tells you everything about Ernie. Even on his biggest night, he first stopped by this poor church just to roll down the window and say hello, and not in a celebrity way. He wanted to meet the pastor because he was impressed with him, and that just impresses me to no end.
The article you mentioned in the Free Press is September 20th. It's titled "True Gentleman Ernie Harwell Still Has More to Give," and you say Ernie is entering a phase where he may be more precious than ever.
Well, it's true. You know, one thing I felt bad about that night was it felt like people were just saying goodbye to Ernie Harwell. Now, I don't know how much more time Ernie has left, but sometimes cancer moves very slowly in older people, and Ernie's 91. That's one of the advantages of being older with cancer. And I hope Ernie is given many, many more months, if not years, to be around. And I saw with Maury, his most valuable time was after he got sick and in his dying days when he was able to share so much wisdom. And I'm sure with a guy like Ernie, that's going to be the same case. It's like Maury said, when is a tree most colorful? When its leaves are dying, right? That's when it gets brilliant, just before it dies, brilliant reds, brilliant yellows. And Ernie is in that phase now, and I think he's got a lot to offer. That's why I'm so excited that he's going to be with us at the Fox, because I think his wisdom will come across in a whole different way now that he's really looking at the end of life. And his faith, which he wants to share with people, I think will come across very much in the things that he says that night.
One of the treasures we had was that on opening day, he would share year after year his poem entitled "Baseball." Mitch Albom, could you share with us Ernie Harwell's "Baseball"?
Well, I'll try, but I mean, nobody does this like Ernie. But since I'm better known for my writing, it would be nice for me to actually do some reading of somebody else's writing. And Ernie's a wonderful writer, and started out as a sports writer, and probably would have been a lot better than me had he stayed with it. So I'm probably glad that he went into broadcasting. But this is his poem about baseball. Baseball is a president tossing out the first ball of the season, and a pudgy schoolboy playing catch with his dad on a Mississippi farm. A tall, thin old man waving a scorecard from the corner of his dugout. That's baseball. So is the big fat guy with a bulbous nose running out one of his 714 home runs. There's a man in Mobile who remembers a triple that Honus Wagner hit in Pittsburgh 46 years ago. That's baseball. And so is the scout reporting that a 16-year-old Sandlot pitcher in Cheyenne is the new Walter Johnson. Baseball is a spirited race of man against man, reflex against reflex, a game of inches. Every skill is measured. Every heroic, every failing is seen and cheered or booed and then becomes a statistic. In baseball, democracy shines its clearest. The only race that matters is the race to the bag. The creed is the rule book, and color is merely something to distinguish one team's uniform from another's. Baseball is a rookie, his experience no bigger than the lump in his throat, trying to begin fulfillment of his dream. It's a veteran, too, a tired old man of 35, hoping his aching muscles can pull him through another sweltering August and September. Nicknames are baseball. Names like Zeke and Pie and Kiki and Home Run and Cracker and Dizzy and Dazzy. Baseball is the cool, clear eyes of Rogers Hornsby, the flashing spikes of Ty Cobb, and an overage pixie named Rabbit Marinville. Baseball? It's just a game, as simple as a ball and bat, yet as complex as the American spirit it symbolizes. It's a sport, business, and sometimes even a religion. The fairy tale of Willie Mays making a brilliant World Series catch and then dashing off to play stickball in the streets with his teenage pals. That's baseball. So is husky-voiced Lou Gehrig saying, "I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth." Baseball is cigar smoke and hot roasted peanuts. The sporting news, ladies' day, down in front. Take me out to the ball game, the seventh inning stretch, and the star-spangled banner. Baseball is a man named Campanella telling the nation's business leaders, "You have to be a man to be a big leaguer, but you have to be a lot of little boy in you too." This is a game for America. This is baseball, a game for boys and for men.
That was Mitch Albom sharing with us the poem by Ernie, "Baseball." Mitch, back in January, you wrote an article for Sports Illustrated entitled "The Courage of Detroit." What did you try to tell us in that article?
Well, they had called me and said, "We want somebody to write about what it's like to live in Detroit these days with the Lions losing, you know, 16 games in a row and the economics and the auto business." And I don't generally write magazine articles. And, you know, I pretty much just told them thanks, but, you know, I'm kind of busy and, you know, I was trying to finish Have a Little Faith, the book. And I said, I can't do it. And then I thought about it for a couple of days. And I said, I know what's going to happen here. They're going to send a reporter in, and he's going to look around, and he's going to go visit a couple places, and then write one of those decaying of the Rust Belt cities. So I called him back. I said, I'll write it off the top of my head. I don't have time to do research or anything like that. I'm just going to write what it's been like here. Is that okay? They said, okay. And I worked for like 3 straight days on it, and I just wanted to say that this is a special, unique place of courage, of grit, of family, of values that will survive both the auto turn down and the Lions. And that's what I was trying to get across, and I turned it in on a Saturday. They ran it the next day. It was in the magazine, untouched, and it seemed to strike a nerve.
Last question, Mitch Albom. What advice would you give to our young listeners this evening?
Well, if you're a young listener who wants to be a writer, I would tell you to read. Because you can't become a writer unless you read. And you can't become a musician unless you listen to music. And I don't think you can become a good person unless you practice being a good person. So many of us look at good people in our lives when we're younger, and then we say, well, that's just them, but, you know, I'm going to be this or I'm going to be that. Try being good. Try being polite. Try being kind. And you'll find that it actually feels pretty good. Don't wait until you have to get later in life to actually see that it's cool to be a decent person. This notion that somehow you got to be a bad guy or you have to have an attitude in order to be cool is something that we all went through when we were younger, and we outgrew it. And if we could all go back and talk to our younger selves, we'd probably say, you know, you could have been a little nicer, you could have been a little smarter, you could have been a little better to your folks, you could have been a little bit more contributory to your community. And I guess that's what I would tell a young person. And don't be so hard on yourselves. You know, you'll make mistakes, but you'll get second chances.
Mitch Albom, all the great stories you tell us, thanks.
My pleasure, Jack.
They inspire us. We need it. Please keep doing it. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.